Je devais peut-être d'abord préciser que je ne vais pas parler en français, je vais parler en anglais, parce qu'il y a certains ici qui n'allaient pas comprendre le français. So please allow me to switch to English so that everybody would understand me. Well, I think that I'm a little bit marginal here because I'm the only social scientist on the podium as far as I can see. And my perspective on memory in Africa is perhaps a little different, and also my claim is a little different. I don't believe that it actually disappears or that it is in danger. I believe precisely the contrary, that it emerges everywhere in Africa if you don't look at objects only, but if you look at what people do. So this is the thesis in the beginning, but perhaps I should be a little bit more precise on what I actually do look at. And what I will do is to introduce you to a strand of research that we follow at the Institute of Social Anthropology at the University of Basel in northern Côte d'Ivoire, which is a no peace, no war situation. Between 2002 and 2011, when that part of the country was under rebel domination. And of course, everybody would assume that rebels are not really interested in culture. They're interested in weapons, perhaps, and perhaps still in money, but culture, is that a subject for rebels? Nobody would believe us, but they actually are. And I will tell you a little bit more on what that means. And the second, or the one of the two examples that I will show you, is a cultural center that has been constructed by the rebels in Kohogo, which is the biggest city in northern Côte d'Ivoire. I will tell you a little bit about the patronage of the urban artists that live in the city and that profited from that rebel governance. And secondly, I will introduce you a little bit in our notion of memory, in particular of memory of a violent past and unjust past. The second example comes from August 7 last year, which is the 50th anniversary of independence in Côte d'Ivoire, and which, to my surprise, generated a big event in the rebel-held part of Côte d'Ivoire, but nothing in the southern part that was still under the domination of the state. So the rebels were organizing commemorative ceremonies for the state that they were combating. That is something that is, I believe, is quite original, and it led also to original demonstrations and ceremonies. Thirdly, I will talk a little bit about societal memory, or collective memory, if you prefer that, because I believe it is necessary to link it to some projectivity. So I don't believe that memory can exist without addressing, at the very same moment, the projectivity of the social imaginary in a given society. And one of the reasons why I would prefer to do this in English is also because of the key notions that we work with are very difficult to translate into French. Capacité d'agir, vilain. Agency is something that is precise, that has been worked upon, which is a learned concept that we can work with. So, Côte d'Ivoire, there is a law since 1984 that forbids to translate the name into English or in any other language, so everybody says Côte d'Ivoire today. Côte d'Ivoire, since 2002, meant field work under fire. So we were doing field work in the northern part. You see the blue band that crosses Côte d'Ivoire here, and the northern part of the country, roughly 60%, was in this time held by rebel forces, while the state under the defunct state now of Laurent Gbagbo was covering the remaining 40% in the southern part. So the blue band itself was controlled by the United Nations peacekeeping forces, and later by Les Forces Impartiales, so by mixed forces of rebels and loyal soldiers. So what I present here refers to the time between 2002, or to be more precise, between September 19, 2002, and between April 11 this year. The place that I will talk on is Kohogo, where you see the blue arrow here, a city of 170,000 inhabitants. So there are but estimations, because the last census was done in 1989, and since then we're relying on estimations only. So First, I would like to say a few words about the people we met. And if I say we, it's a small group of researchers that come from the University of Varsovia 4. So the first experience was that every participant in the war was not only able to speak, that they actually addressed us and wanted to give interviews to us. And sometimes they started very early in the morning at about 8 and ended at 8 in the evening, sometimes interrupted by tears because the memories were so traumatizing. But nonetheless, everybody claimed in that part of the country that the rebellion of 2002 was a just rebellion because it put an end to the domination and to the foreign domination of the southerners. They didn't hesitate to tell us about their memories of war, but they also told us that their own families sometimes didn't want to listen to what they had to tell them, because the families always claimed that they had enough hard times and that they don't need new ones. That is a phenomenon that many of you will, perhaps the elder of you, will remember after World War II in, perhaps not here because Switzerland was not so much touched by that war, but in other countries as France, Germany and elsewhere. The memories came about 20 years later only. So the person that you see here, the individual that you see here is a 17-year-old who has participated in the Battle of Mons twice, in the most cruel part of the country, in the western part of the country. You would call him probably a child soldier. But the image of the state still persists. So the rebels used the money that they raised, for instance, by taxing the markets and also the overland transport to Mali and Burkina Faso, to renovate their own barracks first, and second also to build monuments, as this monument of the unknown rebel soldier, which was inaugurated precisely 6 years after the rebellion started. And you see him, he is carrying an AK-47, something that you should know when you're doing fieldwork there, and a hand grenade in his left hand. And of course it is somebody who was, it's a monument that was inaugurated together with the representatives of what they call civil society. So with a Catholic priest, a Muslim imam, and they had a football match in front of the monument that evening, and civil society against rebels, and made the civil society 1-0 against the rebels. The other images of the state that are appropriated by the rebels and others. So it is to some extent renovating the city or putting new marks in the visual culture of the city. So the, what became Independence Square was later then rebaptized as a Square of the Rebellion. It was the former Place Charles de Gaulle. So that is also something that you might experience here in other countries too. What I would like to show to you is Womenyan. It's good for us all, so the literal translation of it. And that is a cultural center that was actually constructed by the rebels. You wouldn't expect rebels actually to construct cultural centers, as I said already in the beginning. But they have governance in the field of culture, and this is one strand of governance that they actually engage in. So this is the tribune that was constructed by the rebel commander of Zone 10, Fourfier Kouakou Martin, which you, whom you will see a little later, in 2006. It was a former sports ground, a multi-purpose sports ground, which was then transformed into this center. The walls were covered by murals, and the rebel leader, Kouakou, had invited all the artists that live in the city, which are about a group of 12 to 13 who are still active in the city. And believe it or not, this is not an idyllic landscape from the beginning of all times. It is a political picture because it generated and stimulated a debate. It made political articulation possible because they debated about, is that a just or is that an appropriate depiction of how our country looked like before the Europeans came? So it was not just the picture. Perhaps you're a little bit familiar with the writings of Horst Bredekamp, who said that you have speech acts and you also have picture acts. And picture acts can stimulate political articulation too. And that's precisely what happened here. Usually, in many of the murals, the old times are depicted as peaceful and just. The just is very important here. So they say there has been no discrimination of whoever was living in the country, and for them it is easy to recognize that this is in Sinofoland, in the northern parts of Cote d'Ivoire, because of the mountain in the back, which resembles a little bit Kohogo Mountain, right next to the city. Of course, you would have other pictures too, pictures that commemorate colonial domination. Perhaps one or the other among you is a little bit familiar with another version of this picture, because there is another version that has been published in school books in West Africa. I don't know if you, those of you who have gone to school in West Africa, still remember these school books. But the painter here actually transformed it a little, because what he did is that he put the hand of this tirailleur sénégalais, so of this Senegalese rifle, on the back of the French officer, which was not allowed according to the military law of France. So it is a little bit subversive. Well, you could claim that art is always subversive, otherwise it would not be good art. But in this case, it was not, let me say, an accidental act. It was done intentionally. And on the other hand, the people who were talking about this picture when they were visiting the center said that they say that the colonial state, and that is not something that I invent myself, it's a quotation, was still capable of doing something, while the post-colonial state, in particular after the first 20 years, was no longer capable of doing anything but was simply corrupt. What extent this image of the post-colonial state took becomes apparent in this mural. The person you see on the left is known to everybody here in this hall, I believe, in this lecture hall. It's Félix Houphouët-Boigny, le père fondateur, the founding father of the independent nation. But according to this artist, he did not construct an independent nation. He constructed the Tower of Babel, which then fell apart. For those of you who are a little bit familiar with the political culture of Cote d'Ivoire, it would come as a surprise that a figure like Houphouët-Boigny is criticized in that way. It is something that would not have been possible before the crisis. And the literal translation that I would quote here is "On se comprend plus," which means that he was not really putting people together, but that he was just claiming to bring them together while they were actually drifting apart. That ended then in the crisis of the 90s, the crisis that is perhaps best known under the generic term of Ivoirité, which can be translated as Ivorianness or as Ivoirité, a ethno-nationalist ideology that claimed that only persons who were coming from ethnic groups that initially lived in Cote d'Ivoire had a right to full citizenship. And what that meant becomes visible in this picture. The persons that you see here are harassed and by the soldiers of the regular army of Cote d'Ivoire. I will go into another detail very soon, but what I would like to show here is that these soldiers didn't even hesitate to batter an old man recognizable from his white hair, and also even they were beating pregnant women. The person that you see in the upper back here, in the upper right here, that is the rebel leader. The rebel leader, Fofie Kwaku, who shouts stop to this and who holds the Kalashnikov in his hands. And I was talking to the artist who has painted this, and I said, was this commissioned by the rebel leader? Because that is what I suspected. And he said, not that. He said, on the contrary, he was very afraid because he was painting it. And the rebel leader was not aware of the fact that he was actually painting such a picture. And suddenly, when he nearly came to an end, he noticed that somebody was standing behind him, and it was actually the rebel leader. And then the rebel leader said, yeah, just continue what you did. But actually, this center has been covered twice. So this picture was later replaced by another one that depicted the more recent history of Cote d'Ivoire. The identity card is a special mark of this time, because having an identity card with a Northerner's name, and that meant names that also are carried by citizens of Mali or Burkina Faso, meant that you had a good chance to pay more at roadblocks, for instance, of any force, armed force in the country. So if, for instance, you were called Koulibaly or Keita, it meant that you had to pay at least twice as much as somebody whose name was Conan or another Baole name. Also, the quotation here in the lower left is something that I heard very often. They carried weapons, and we didn't have anything. So images and imagination are the key notions that I apply here, together with the notion of picture. Picture is a material thing. Image is something that you carry in your head. It's mental. That is based on the picture theory by William Mitchell, whom you might know. Imagination is a process. It's a social practice. It's not something that is simply there. It is practiced from one day to the other, and it's a social process. Okay, I'll take more. Which means imagination is closely linked, on the one hand, to the habitual representation of the past, and on the other hand, to the imagination of the future. The process of creating images and memory is something that is inevitably related to how you feel in the present. It is a central element of agency. Agency is, for us, composed of three elements. One is imagination, the other is judgment, and the third one is habits or habitual practice, which means that collective memory is an activity. It doesn't exist in an isolated space. So that is the man that was ruling the city of Kuhoga at the time, Fofie Kwaku Martin, on the day of the independence ceremony. He is sought for war atrocities by the United Nations, which he had committed between 2002 and 2003. But when I was asking the artists about their paintings on canvas, they always told me our best paintings are in his collection. He is an art collector. He is a connoisseur. He collects art, and not only modern art, he collects art that he can get. On the other hand, he is somebody who would be considered to be a criminal here. So what's your situation as a social anthropologist, as a field worker? You're getting into a moral dilemma. And everybody said, no, he knows that you're here. You are the only white man in this town, so he knows that you're here. You can go and visit him. And even the United Nations peacekeeping forces knew where he was, because his mansion stood right across the street where the UN Nations barracks were. They pretended not to know where he is. The second element is here more, and I go very quickly through that, a small series of pictures from the independence ceremonies, which is an artwork in itself, because it brings different groups together and imagines how a multi-ethnic society in the country could look like. This is one of the main allies of the rebels, the so-called traditional hunters, which are very well armed. They have Israeli Utsis, for instance, and they also have a good organization carrying badges and so on and so forth, parading here in front of the rebel leader, the commander in charge, and also about a few meters further along the way, in front of the United Nations officers who were looking at the same ceremony. So what would you do then? I mean, would you say, well, I'll go and visit this man and have a look at this art collection? It's still there, by the way. So I'll give you some what was displayed there. It's just a few images. Perhaps you're more interested in this one. This is a Kafiligejo statue that could be part of an ordinary or an art collection here in Europe too. It was presented to Fofie Kwaku, who then said in public that it should remain in the place where it is and that they should well protect it. We try to work with the brain. So when we look at rebel governance, we would not like to intervene because, well, of course, we would not be in a position to do that. But working with the brain means that we could perhaps foster the already existing structures that protect certain images and certain objects in the field, if we look at the practice. I've seen this, yes. So what I would like to point out here is that collective memory is perhaps not in crisis. If you look at the practice, it has taken another shape here. There was a double dislocation in this event, a dislocation that came from Ivoirité-Ivoirienness. But this dislocation did not interrupt the production, the collective production of how we remember the past. It stimulated even more. And there were several social spaces where this collective memory actually did find a place and where it was displayed. So it is there. But it is there as a practice. It's not there as an object. And rebel governance meant that they were at least interested in some of these social spaces because they were building the center. It was not in the UNESCO. And nobody asked them to do it. It was not somebody from outside who asked them to build a cultural center and protect these things. It is something that grew out of the local society. Of course, they did it perhaps for other reasons, we have to be honest here, because they were looking for legitimacy, and the legitimacy was sought in the past and projected into the future, and the present was just in the middle. But, and that's perhaps my final remark here, does that matter if it helps? Thank you for your attention.
Ça reste dans le noir, mais c'est pas bien grave.
En Afrique, il fait toujours noir.
Donc, merci beaucoup, M. Foster, pour cette présentation de nouveaux enjeux sur les questions mémorielles.